All right, well, welcome to this class. I titled it Responding Helpfully to Emotional Health Needs. And I discover that when people have trouble, everybody wants to help. Everybody wants to help. But not all help is helpful. And so we want to talk a little bit about how to be helpfully helpful. And I always say it this way, that if you are directly involved, be involved. But if you're not a direct part of the situation, then be careful about your opinions and observations and how much you talk, because people in trouble are very sensitive to slander and gossip and what feels damaging. And so... one of the ways to be helpful is to just be careful. I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about the power of prayer. We said yesterday that every mental health struggle is a spiritual battle. It feels intensely spiritual, and we know that the devil uses affliction to destroy people. Even if the cause is physiological. The cause may not be spiritual, and yet the devil will try to use the pain and the anguish of the situation to destroy souls. And so it is very important to pray for the situation, pray around it, pray for the people involved. It's an essential requirement for any helper. We often pray, and when someone's facing surgery, we pray, well, that the Lord would guide the hands of the surgeon. And I've personally asked for prayer before a surgery, and the doctor said, yes, please, let's pray together. And that was a blessing to know that the doctor invited my prayer. It wasn't my surgery, but he invited that participation. And so the same is true in these cases. The doctors need our prayers. The counselors need our prayers, even if they're not believers. And we're going to talk a little bit today about involving people that are not of our faith and of our culture in these kinds of situations. But before we go any further, I would like to invite you to share any scriptures that come to mind about prayer as it might relate to this kind of a problem. And I would invite your testimonies.
And the prayer of faith shall save the sick.
That's right. And that word save actually has more of the connotation of comfort and protect than healing. It's interesting to me to study that. Any others?
Confess your faults one to another and pray one for another.
Okay. What was that? I didn't hear. I'm a little bit hard on hearing.
I said, confess your faults.
Yeah, and pray one for another that you may be healed. Very well. I'm thinking about the time when the disciples tried to solve a problem, and they asked Jesus why they weren't effective. And Jesus said, well, this kind of spirit doesn't come out except by prayer and fasting. And so it's right for us to acknowledge our inability to solve problems. I think sometimes we don't sense that keenly enough. We think, well, here's a problem and we have what we need to answer it. And yet, we don't, and the Lord needs to teach us how to depend on Him in prayer. remember the morning I got the call from Dominican Republic that my son was irrational. And the first thing I did was called my wife out to my office to tell her what was happening. And we had prayer together. And then we gathered the family together and prayed. And I called for a ticket. I called Marvin Mass to Golden Rule Travel to get a ticket as quick as I could and told him what the situation was. And he said, get on the road. You got a passport? I said, yes, I have a passport. He said, well, get on the road. I'll get you a ticket. Because we had 2 hours to the airport. And so my oldest son took me to the airport. And on the way, Marvin Mass gave me two options. If I could make the first one, you know, this was the first option. And then gave me a second one. He said, call me back if you can't make that flight. Well, when I got into Minneapolis Airport, the line for security was, it just looked like it was snake way back. And the man I walked up behind said, this was the beginning of November. And he said, well, with any luck, we'll be through here by Thanksgiving. you know, 10 minutes later, I was through security. I still don't know how it happened. The line just moved. I didn't jump the line. They opened up some more gates or something, but the line moved and I was through security and I made the flight. So prayer, that's my testimony. Bathe it in prayer. Now, moving on then a little bit, some general observations about, excuse my emotions, I'm sorry, I should be able to talk about this. New and frightening problems are not new and frightening to everybody. What I mean by that is that these problems are as old as man, at least as old as the fall of man. And so when I got back home from Dominican Republic, the first thing I did is I consulted with a young man that was in medical training. He was attending our church, Dr. Schrock. I don't know if you know him, but he was interning locally there and attending our church while he interned. And I just went and I said, what are we looking at? Well, the first thing I asked him, I said, can a lack of sleep disorganize a mind this badly? Because my son had quit sleeping and then fell apart. And he listened to my story and he said, well, I'm going to tell you something you probably don't want to hear. He said, that sounds like the manic phase of bipolar, and that's why he quit sleeping, was the revving up of emotions. It wasn't the lack of sleep that caused it. It was the problem that caused the lack of sleep, which we found to be true. And so, but what was reassuring to me was that he was familiar with the territory. I wasn't. It was totally frightening to me, and to talk with somebody that had studied and had learned and had some background was reassuring. And so when the symptoms started to reappear a month later, we went to the doctor and so on. So just remember that just because you're looking at something that looks bizarre, it looks incomprehensible, it looks irrational, and it is, somebody has probably observed it and studied it and chronicled it before and can give you some sense of direction in it. These problems are the way they are partly because we are created by God. And when we go wrong, we do it in predictable ways. There are certain ways, certain patterns that emerge when people lose their sanity. When someone has a mental breakdown, there are certain things that happen. And so while it doesn't solve the problem, it can be a bit reassuring to read a chronicle that hey, that fits. You know, every step fits to the T. And this isn't something new. So Next thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about is that we have a tremendous cultural fear as Mennonites, but it's not just Mennonites. Even I've talked to people, work acquaintances and so on, that we're afraid of getting the wrong kind of help. When we have this thing that's new and different and we just don't know for sure where to turn. And we also know that the world is full of opportunists and quacks and people that are willing to take advantage of a situation. But what I've observed is that our fear sometimes leads us right into the arms of those people. Because we're afraid of psychology. Have you ever heard psychology over the pulpit like it was a dirty word? I have. The fear of getting trapped in some kind of false philosophy. And those are real fears. I don't want to downplay that fear, but just want to share a few thoughts about it. I have a couple things I'm thinking about. How many of you remember the verse I read in Deuteronomy 28:28 yesterday? Well, some of you weren't here, but that verse says this. It says that Deuteronomy 28 says that the Lord shall smite thee with madness and blindness and astonishment of heart. And it's talking about the curse of men that have gone into sin. And so it's real easy to read a verse like that and right away put the weight of moral failure and implication on mental affliction. But if you read that whole passage, it talks about the scab and the boil and emrods, and it lists all kinds of physical afflictions. And for some reason, we're willing to go to the doctor for all of the others. But if it's madness, then we're afraid to go to the doctor. Isn't that a puzzle? What is psychology, anyway? Anybody have some thoughts about what psychology is, why we might be afraid of it?
It's a study of the mind.
It is.
Psychology.
The study of our psyche.
And one of the reasons I think that we fear is because there's so many different frameworks through which people view humanity, and one of them is a godless view. And often when you start off with the wrong view of who we are and where we come from, you end up with wrong solutions.
Wrong philosophies about it. And that Freud, Sigmund Freud and his Freudian psychology, it has been largely debunked, although there are still practitioners of applied psychology in the Freudian school. There's never been any scientific foundation for it. It hasn't. It's a philosophical framework. It's not a scientific framework. And so that has kind of popularized the whole field of psychology in the 1800s. And our reserve is kind of linked to that. But psychology has actually changed and gone through a number of metamorphoses since the days of Sigmund Freud. And so there are psychological frameworks that are much nearer accurate to human motivation, human behavior than what Sigmund Freud was. But anyway, there are lots of ditches and pitfalls in that world. And then we have the psychiatry field, which is more of a effort to medicalize human behavior. And that has its pitfalls because human behavior typically is a sin problem. It's not a medical problem. And to medicalize every child that is obstinate and stubborn in school is faulty thinking as well. And so what I'm getting at is there are reasons to fear a false science in our search for answers. However, all the people that I encountered in this field, the secular field of mental health, really did care about people. That's why they were there. They really did want to help people. And my observation was that in the current training framework, they are trained to respect the culture of the person that they're treating. And we found that to be universally true, that we never found anybody that blamed our culture for the problem. They had seen the problem many times before, and they understood. I mean, I think that's part of our fear, is that somehow, because we're Christians, because we're Mennonites, because we're a unique ethnic group, that somehow that's going to become the focus, or that's going to be threatened by the path toward health. And, you know, I'll just tell you a little story. The current doctor that my son has, in his initial interview, he went all the way back through my son's life and the things that he had done, the occupational things, and his longest period of stability was when he was teaching school. Oh, okay. Well, then you should go back to school. I mean, he was earning a living and supporting a family, and he really thought that, you know, in light of that, well, the best thing that my son could do was become a professor. I mean, if that's, you know, if you got the intellect, you got the, you know, get a job in education. Well, my son actually was feeling a little bit threatened by that. You know, he called me and said, how am I supposed to think? Because, I said, well, he's simply doing what he's trained to do. He's trying to find the direction to, but I said, I'm pretty sure if you tell him that your goal is to work with your own boys and your own family and in the business that you are in, he won't argue with that. And he hasn't. He has been very helpful and supportive to my son's decision. But it was just interesting to me how that he analyzed the background of this situation and came to that conclusion of, well, academics, that's where you ought to, and maybe my son will end up back in school, I don't know, but at least at this point he's not. I just would like to say it this way, that when we approach the helping professions like psychiatry or psychology, counseling, doctoring, we do it on much the same footing that we would consult with a lawyer. Or we need their expertise. We need their training. No, we're not going to adopt their worldview necessarily, but we are going to draw from them what we need for the situation. We'll get back around to that a little bit if we have time. All right, let's go to some of the basics of responding helpfully. I said let's start with the basics. I have a list of things there. And I invite your discussion a little bit about that, but just taking them down through diet, much could be said on the subject of diet. There are extreme views in this department, of course, like there is everywhere else, but there are some basic facts about nutrition that we ought to pay attention to. Someone has a difficulty, a mental difficulty, let's at least make sure that they're not overdosing on sugar, that they're not overly processed foods, excessive sugar. Keep a basic approach to diet. You know, you're probably going to find out from somebody that what you need is this bottle or that pill or this supplement or that. And don't that can actually complicate things. If you start down the road, I know of a situation where a family was, somewhat health-minded, and which all right, but in the face of a problem, they went into the thing of supplements and diets, and a matter of years elapsed till they actually ended up at the hospital, taking the father off of everything, starting back over with some basic antidepressants, and 3 months later he's back on the job and functioning and happy and being a dad. And you know, how much time? I'm just saying, don't lose too much time in the diet department. You know, make sure it's right, but don't keep it basic. Don't assume the problem is dietary unless there's some obvious trigger. And some of these problems can escalate rapidly if we spend too much time on things that are not the real problem. We're maybe making things more complicated. Sleep. This one is very basic. Sleep issues are almost always involved in mental health struggles, both not sleeping and oversleeping can be an issue, although sleeping typically is good. The mind does need sleep to recalibrate. I don't know what all goes on in here when you sleep, but it's a lot. And, you know, you can be feeling trapped and depressed, and you go to bed and you get a good night's sleep, and hey, the sun came up and you're ready to go back to work. And, you know, sleep is a tremendous essential ingredient of healthy living. And so right away, I mean, the first thing, and this was of the Lord. When my dad called me, the first question I asked him was, is he sleeping? And the only reason I ask that, if I reflect on it, is the fact that my wife's struggles are very sleep-related. And so that was just the first thing in my mind, is he sleeping? Fact is, he hadn't. He wasn't sleeping. He'd gone 3 nights straight without any sleep, and he had decided that he didn't need to sleep anymore. And you know, so it was. So I said, well, find a sleeping pill. You know, find a sleeping pill. Just put him down. And they did. They found a sleeping pill. There was a lady in the church in Dominican Republic, a native lady, that had a prescription sleeping pill that they gave it to him. And when he woke up, I was there. He slept for a day and a night. I mean, when he woke up after a day of sleep, and they gave him another one, put him down a second time. And when he woke up, he seemed totally normal. We went for a walk that morning. And as soon as we were out of earshot of everybody in the place where he was staying there, he just broke down and cried, Dad, what happened? You know. And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know what happened. But I said, you know, we're here to take care of you. But, you know, he functioned normally for a month before any symptoms resurfased. And so, but the sleeping, what I wanted to say about that divine intervention, the sleeping pill they gave him was Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic. And it's used as an antipsychotic, and it also has a strong sleep effect. And so what she had as a prescription sleeping pill in Dominican Republic probably was off-label use for us. But when the doctor heard, I kept the wrapper of that pill because I wanted to show the doctor when I got home, you know, this is what he had. He looked at that and said, you couldn't have found anything better to give him. And so that's part of my, all right, I'm sharing that as a testimony. Pray, depend on God. He will provide. And so sleep is a big issue. Sufferer will often benefit from more sleep rather than less. But there is the excessive sleep side, especially in depressive problems, depressions, too much sleep. And that leads us into the thing of discipline and structure. One of the blessings of nuclear families and cohesive church communities is that there is a structure around these problems. There should be a structure around these problems that doesn't exist in the broader culture. I don't know how many times my wife and I heard this. Well, you know, doctor, tell my son, you are so lucky. And what they were talking about was the family framework. That he said, so many of the people that we're trying to help, they come to us from the prison or from the police or from the, and they've blown up their lives. Their family has turned their back on them and said, we can't help them. And they, and there's, so the doctor tries to help, but he doesn't have any structure to put it back into, you know, and so there's this desperation, and they, it just felt to me like the doctors really enjoyed working with our family because they knew there was a safe environment around the situation. And so provide that, provide the structure that a person needs to be safe.
Excuse me, sorry about the bell. Ignore,
huh?
That was the wrong time.
Oh.
Ignore the bell.
Okay. Now, the fact is that some of these problems can become overwhelming in the family context. And that's why it is, I think it's helpful to have places like Green Pastures or institutions that we can trust when a situation gets beyond the ability of a family context to deal with. Because there's tremendous stress that comes out of these situations into the family. And my own testimony is that our church was very caring and very supportive. I don't want to minimize their role. That's what carried us through. But not everyone has that context. So let's be sensitive to the ability of a family. And I've helped in situations where there was a respite situation developed, where certain hours of the day this child was under the care of another person for 4 hours. And that way, mom, dad, siblings got a break from the situation. So let's try to help provide that for each other. Let's discuss discipline a little bit. Is it possible that our view of discipline becomes detrimental in a mental health situation? I think the answer is yes, because discipline works through the framework of acceptance and love. It has to work that way. And people that are battling mental health breakdown, mental health issues, usually cannot feel love. They become broken in their ability to experience emotions and express emotion. And so trying to apply the normal discipline to normal, and I've talked with parents that have struggled with tremendous guilt over this very issue. Our situation developed in a matter of days, and so we knew we had an odd problem. We knew it wasn't a behavior related issue when it happened. But I've talked to parents where the same type of end product happened over the period of a year, you know, where it slowly, and you know, all the time they're thinking it's behavior, stubbornness, it's, you know, and pound. Suddenly, one day the child is catatonic and they can't move, and you know, and then they realize that something in the neurological framework has quit working. And then they feel tremendous guilt, you know, that why didn't we see it quicker? So yes, we want to provide a safe and disciplined environment for these situations, but let's be careful about our discipline approach, how we impose the disciplines. And that leads us to coaching and counseling. Many of these struggles require some investment in mental training to recover, to reestablish good patterns, and this takes time. But I'd like to just talk a little bit about professional versus lay counseling. So somehow we get the idea that you have to be a counselor to counsel. Well, maybe it's the other way around. You are a counselor if you counsel. If you give counsel, you're a counselor. Maybe it's that way around, instead of the other way around, that if you're a counselor, then what you give is counsel. Playing with semantics, I know, but it's taking time to talk and listen and help unhealthy thought patterns, to point them out, to help derail them, bring them back toward a healthier thought pattern. It takes tremendous time. Once the mind has broke down, to get it rebuilt. Now, there are ways to do it. It takes time, but it does not necessarily take a professional approach. There are some things to learn, and what I think is important for us to remember in getting involved in therapy work is that let's make sure that everyone's working together. You know, that we aren't trying to impose some sort of therapy because it's our pet idea and someone else has some other idea about how to approach it, and we only make confusion and trouble out of the situation. Let's try to work together and minimize stress. What qualifies a helper? I have a list of things: attitude, understanding, curiosity, determination, patience. Attitude. What I want to touch on here is that ask yourself carefully, if you want to be a helper, who am I doing this for? It seems like a strange question, doesn't it? Who am I doing this for? But I remind parents, when they're working with little children, you're not in this for yourself, you're in this for the child. And the same is true when we have a mental health situation. You're not in this for yourself, you're in this for the other person. So you need to lay aside agendas, preconceived ideas about, you know, your contribution and the value of it, and focus on the need at hand. And that leads to the thought of understanding. What do you actually know about this kind of a problem? What do you know, and are you willing to learn? Are you curious? Are you willing to discover how these things unfold? What the trajectory is? So if this happens, what does that mean? And what are we looking at? That's such a critical part. One of the things that I learned in my work with doctors is they enjoyed my curiosity. And if they discovered that I wanted to know why, then they were willing to tell me why. And the first doctor was a lady, and we just happened to get assigned to her, and she told me a couple times that I love to teach. and she did. She was a good teacher, but, you know, it was new territory. It was new territory for me, and I just asked questions, and I feel like that was helpful, because it helped her realize that I wasn't just a passive actor here. I wasn't just dumping this off on the doctor. I wanted to know what I could do. And so that curiosity is an important element if you want to be a helper. The other thing is determination. What I mean by that is, if you get involved, stay involved. If you're going to be a helper, you're going to have to be more than a fair weather helper. You're going to have to ride the thing through the toughest of times. And so don't despair if things don't go the way you think they should. Stick it out. Learn what to do next. And that requires patience as well. What to do if you don't see the results you expect? Then maybe there's something else you need to learn. We somehow get the idea that because these problems are not common, and sometimes they get mired up in controversy, that maybe we should just turn it over to the professionals. Just kind of wash our hands of it. I don't advocate that. I think that the Christian church ought to be a safe place for people to have problems, and you and I are the ones that make that happen. If it's safe for somebody to have trouble, That's because we have made it safe for them to have a problem. Now let's think a little bit about what qualifies a professional. Be interested in a professional's philosophy. When you consult with a doctor, whether it's a medical doctor, whether he's referring you to a behavioral health, or whether he's referring you to a psychiatrist, ask that doctor, what do you believe about the mind? Is it a spiritual entity? Is it just physical? Or, you know, dig into his philosophy, challenge his thinking, share the gospel. What do they believe about morality and guilt? I think guilt is one of the tremendous emotions, one of the highest, most uncomfortable emotions that we can have. And some mental afflictions involve a lot of guilt. And so understanding how a counselor looks at guilt, and a lot of this guilt involved is false guilt, and you know, it's just the emotion, it's not the real, it's not actually a sin question, but a person feels tremendously condemned and guilty, and so that's an important issue to discuss with a professional. What do they understand about medication? And this was one that where a lot of my understanding of medication came out of that first doctor that we visited. I just asked her point blank. I said, "How does medication work? What are you doing? Do you know what you're doing?" And her first answer was, "Well, there's a lot more that we don't know than what we do know." And to me, that was a reassuring answer because, you know, there wasn't a cocky, well, we know what we're doing type of approach. But she was the one that explained the blood-brain barrier to me and why it's so hard to treat the brain. And I'm going to run out of time, but that's the whole subject of medication, I had that way down here at the end of... I wanted to quickly go through a number of therapies here before we get to medication. The pastor, the counselor, and the doctor all have an important role in the support and healing of the afflicted mind, but all three have to be able to focus on the need at hand and not on their own agenda or opinion. I think that's where your outline stops. Now, what I'd like to do in the little bit of time left is just talk about some of the therapies and then talk about medication, but we're not going to get over everything. We talked a little about anxiety and OCD yesterday. I'd like to come back to those just a little bit. OCD is actually an anxiety symptom. So the therapies for OCD and anxiety overlap. Phobias, irrational fears, social anxiety, they're all connected. Regardless of the specific disorder, the underlying processes that drive them often follow similar patterns. People with anxiety tend to react to unpleasant thoughts, feelings, and situations in a more extreme way, and they try to avoid things that trigger them, and that's what leads them into behaviors, avoidance behaviors, trying to stay away from anxiety. So, addressing that emotional process is the focus of cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. That's the acronym for it. And CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, has become one of the leading methods, successful methods, of altering behavior in today's counseling world. It's far more effective than Freudian psychology. It actually does produce measurable results. The premise of CBT is that your thoughts affect how you feel and behave more than your situation does. So we respond to our emotions more readily than we respond to our environment. Our feelings about things count more with our response more than the actual environment. So, the goal of cognitive behavioral therapy is to identify where your emotions are divergent from the environment. So, you feel unsafe. Does that mean you are unsafe? focusing on the divergence between reality and the emotional reality. Emotional realities are real. Not real real, but yes, they are. I mean, the way you experience things matters. And I even ran across this in some sales training that I took. They told us that that people choose to buy on their emotions, not on their logic. Your job is to give them support for their logic to follow their emotions. You know, if they want what you want to sell, then you need to give them some logic, because they're going to follow their emotions. You just need to give them the ladder to climb on. And well, that really sounds logical, doesn't it? So we think things through and so on, but now people actually follow their feelings. And that's, so it's this, when this thing gets out of sync, cognitive behavioral therapy is trying to bring it back. Exposure therapy is another branch of the same therapy. And that's where there's certain fears, feeling maybe fears of a crowd or so on, where a person is reassured that they're safe and then taken into the environment that they're afraid of, and help to experience the very thing that they've been avoiding, slowly introducing anxiety-causing situations and teaching a person how to relax in an anxiety situation. Part of this involves maybe some writing assignments. List the things that you're afraid of. Rank them in intensity, helping a person sort through, why do I feel the way I do? And we can use imagination in these situations, where help a person imagine something that is causing a panic attack, and learn to get comfortable thinking about it, rather than actually exposing directly. Train the mind to accept the situation without panicking about it. A lot of times these problems escalate because a person is poorly self-aware. They don't have a very good monitor of their own emotions. And teaching them how to experience feelings and sense and stay in touch with reality at the same time. The other thing that sometimes is helpful to help somebody think about an anxiety-producing, or, you know, if an anxiety-producing thought comes into their mind, think of it like a leaf on a stream. You know, it you see it land there, and it'll flow right down that stream, and it'll flow out the other end of the stream, and you don't have to do anything about it. A thought can come, an emotion can come, and you don't have to do anything about it. You can just let it be. Sometimes someone, especially if the thinking maybe involves sexual imagery or something like that, is so, I'm not that way, I don't want to be that way, you know, and you can get obsessed with the thought itself rather than just accepting that I'm human, this is part of my experience, I don't have to do anything about it. This thought does not have to turn into behavior, and that's part of therapy. Art therapy can sometimes have a place both in calming and relaxed. Some people are artistic. My wife does a lot of adult coloring books. It's just part of her ability to quiet her mind. If something's stressing her, just do some artwork. Be creative. Do, you know, turn the mind to something, to beauty and order. Some of these situations involve interpersonal therapy, where the social relationships, some people struggle a lot with social relationships, so that's what drives their anxiety. So learning to discuss and talk about social realities is part of therapy sometimes. Am I supposed to be finished here? Pretty cool. Let's talk about medicine just a little bit. If you need to get up and leave, we'll just go ahead. But what about medication? Typically, most analysis of outcomes today is pointing to therapy and medication as giving the best overall lifestyle outcomes, where people are able to function normally, fruitfully, comfortably. There are some problems, like eating disorders, where the outcome between therapy and medication are dead equal. The problem is, medication is easy and therapy is hard as far as time-consuming, expensive. And so typically, medication, if the results are equal, medication is sometimes just the simplest way to go. But medication is not simple. The focus of research and development has largely been around SSRIs, which is selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, SNRIs. Those two comprise most of the research and development so far. And I'm going to tell you a little story why those two are in focus and have been developed. Back in the 60s, when Woodstock happened, before my time, but the young people got to using LSD. LSD was a hallucinatory drug. Well, these people had visions and dreams, and they showed up in emergency rooms in manic state. You know, it would trigger a mania that scared them. Not everyone had that kind of response, but there was enough of them. Is it time to quit? Open the door. Enough of these incidents happened that it caught the attention of researchers, and they started to study what LSD did in the brain. How did it trigger? And what it was doing was fueling a tremendous uptake of serotonin and norepinephrine. And so, okay, so if we can slow that process down, you know, if we can go the other direction. And so that's where the SSRIs and the SNRIs started to be developed. It was through the trying to reverse engineer what LSD was doing in the brain. And it opened a whole, I mean, all right, lithium salts had already been used to try to dampen down mania before that. But this one actually started to allow people, that just calmed them, you know, it would shut down a mania, but it didn't necessarily allow a person to function well. The SSRIs were able to not only tamp down the unwanted activity, but largely help a person to function. So I find that whole process fascinating. Okay, so the other thing that LSD showed them was how to get an action through the blood-brain barrier. There are very few things that you can take in your body that will affect your brain. God has designed it that way, that the blood-brain barrier back here isolates the circulation of blood and fluid in your brain and spinal cord from the rest of your body to protect your mind. And so, I'm sorry, I'm still going. And so, the one doctor explained it this way to me. He said, what we've had to do, most of these medications, what we've had to do is have a negative impact on the body. So then the body itself counteracts the negative impact of the medication, and in the process, it changes the brain chemistry. And that's why the side effects of psychotropic medications are instant. You know, the first week you feel horrible, and the second week you feel horrible again, and the third week, maybe, and you know, a few weeks later, hey, I feel good. And it's this adjustment process, because they can't get medication directly into the brain, then they have to use kind of a backdoor approach like that. So anyway, medication, that's why it's side effects are immediate, positive effects are delayed, and it's not a silver bullet. What there's lots of real small tweaks in formulations. What works for one person might, I mean, what helps one person might be damaging to another person, and so it's medication is a process. And I that's why I say again, like I did yesterday, I don't recommend starting down the road of medication in children. I'm not saying it would never be appropriate, but it just seems to me like we should need to let that brain and body mature before we decide that that's the only mechanism we have. I wanted to talk a little bit about neuroplasticity and neurodiversity and some of the philosophies of the day, but we're out of time. Thank you for your willing attention.